Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello, this is The Ruck from The Times and The Sunday Times, and just when we thought that this year's Six Nations was turning into an Irish procession, the championship threw up one of its great days. A Saturday of shocks in Rome and in London, followed by Wales falling to defeat to France in Cardiff. A reminder of why it is a tournament which delivers year on year. Welcome back, I'm Alfie Reynolds, returned from Australia. Who thought it was a good idea to go on holiday in the middle of the Six Nations, but back in time for a brilliant weekend of rugby. And I'm delighted to be back alongside the Times chief rugby correspondent, Alex Lowe. Hi, Alex.
That's a promotion, but I'll take it.
What's the official title?
Congrats on the pay rise.
Just rugby correspondent. I'll take it. Thanks, Alfie. He comes back, promotes me.
Amazing.
Brilliant.
And also the deputy rugby correspondent. Yeah. Have I got that one right?
Yeah, that is me. Yeah, hello.
Deputy to the chief rugby correspondent.
Yes, that's the joke, yeah. You're looking very tanned, Alfie.
It's funny you say that, because when I turned up at Twickenham, was in the queue to collect my accreditation on Saturday, I saw Alan Dimmock, friend of the pod, Alan from Dundee, and the first thing he said to me was, I thought you'd be a lot more tanned than you are.
There you are, you've got a nice glow on you.
It'll be gone in
loads
a
of energy. It's week five of the week eight of the Six Nations. So you bringing some energy, like a Faye Wabosa coming on the wing, is helpful for us.
The Six Nations cut through in, were you in Melbourne?
In Melbourne, yeah.
Big Six Nations weekends in Melbourne, or they had a whole round of Super Rugby, didn't they, while you were there?
Yeah, which I couldn't quite get to, which was really frustrating. I was hoping to get to some Super Rugby, had the whole farce of going on with the Rebels at the moment,
being in
administration, and tickets for their opening game only went on sale on like the Tuesday or Wednesday before the game on the Friday night or something for the opening round.
Sounds a bit familiar from last season.
So that is actually a story that's probably worth keeping an eye on out in Australia, what's happening with the Rebels and what's going to go on in Super Rugby. But didn't get to any Super Rugby, disappointingly. Getting up for the Calcutta Cup at 3 a.m. is an interesting way to consume the Six Nations, but I did do that. But no major celebrations for it, unfortunately.
I used to live in Australia, 2002 to 2004, and my now wife came out and joined me for the last year of it. And I remember getting up at like 4 a.m. to go to an Irish bar to watch a Six Nations game. And we were the only ones in there who'd got up to go and watch the game. Everyone else had been in there all night. I was like, could barely stand, could barely see. And Liz was like, what the hell are we doing in here? It's like, we walked into like some zombie place. So we left.
Well, the final thing as well in terms of rugby in Australia is, so being in Melbourne and Victoria, I'm sure plenty of people listening will know this, but some might not, is it's just not rugby country at all. So even the Rebels and their situation was barely in the papers and what was going on there, which was quite interesting, you know, ahead of the Lions, Joe Schmidt coming in.
Well, we found that, didn't we? When 2 years ago when we went to the tour to Australia, Alex, that so we were in Brisbane and the Courier Mail on a Monday after England had beaten Australia in the rugby union had got 300 words in the paper, which was awful. I mean, like, we've got loads of good friends and colleagues out there. There's a tiny band, some of them even paying for themselves to get to matches, weren't they? It's a really small scene of rugby union journalists over in Australia, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking of trying to stop off in Australia this summer when England are on tour, but It always reminds you of a story of Ian Ritchie, former RFU chief exec. 2016 England tour, he was down there and there was a drinks thing or something with the media, the British, the travelling England media. And he said, we may not always agree, we may not like what you say, but at least you're paying attention to the sport. At least it's not an irrelevance. Sometimes the RFU need to be reminded of that, that even if they don't like what we say or what we write, even if we disagree, you know, you pick up the Times today, there's about six pages of rugby in it. That's a great showcase for the sport. And on a weekend when England play like they did, it's only good news.
Well, I was just about to say, I've done 5.5 minutes of the podcast and haven't even mentioned England, Ireland or any of the Six Nations yet. But we're going to get on to all of that. What a weekend. Wins for Italy, England, France. Will is caught up with the Italy back row, Seb Negri, as well. So going to hear an interview with him after their first home Six Nations win in 11 years. We'll get on to maybe more detail in particular about the England game in just a second, but that was one of the great Six Nations Saturdays, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was sensational. I was standing in the, I mentioned it in my piece, but in the line-out bar in the east stand of Twickenham, and it's filling up as the Italy game's going on, and then Louis Leiner's being roared over the line by probably a whole load of Harlequins fans who are cheering him on for his debut try, and then they're all chanting Italia, Italia, and then you get into the England game, and it's different but reminiscent of the World Cup quarterfinal weekend, of just two hugely thrilling, compelling games, different quality, different outcomes, but the idea of two teams who are 4-1 to win at home in the Six Nations, both actually winning, and in the way they did, brilliant.
So I met a friend beforehand who'd come to the game, and he was saying that he hadn't felt that kind of, well, punch his chance, but not really going to happen, since England played New Zealand in 2012, when they'd had an average autumn where they'd messed around against Australia and South Africa. There was that Owen Farrell, Chris Robshaw disagreement about whether to kick a penalty or to the corner against South Africa, I think that was. I think that was also the time where Danny Kerr won his 50th and threw an intercept.
It was, yep.
And then unexpectedly, from nowhere, England beat the All Blacks, who were on a very long unbeaten run. And Manu Tuilagi, Brad Barrett, Chris Ashton were to the fore, Tom Wood and Rob Shaw amazing the breakdown. And it did feel like one of those days, didn't it? That I don't think it was unreasonable for all of us to go on, as we said on the pod with Sam last week, Sam Warburton, probably a 10% chance that England won that game. And actually, interestingly, even on the Six Nations website itself this season, has got this little
Win probability
predictor, yeah, which Alex and I have looked at during games. Yeah. It's quite fun sometimes, and to see how little they back or how much they back a team based on history, stats, whatever. And even with a few minutes to go, Ireland had an 80% chance of winning that game. It totally was unexpected, but how good. This is why we like sport, isn't it? Because you can't tell what's going to happen.
No, it was unbelievable. And I feel like, let's get into England-Ireland. It's almost a case of where to start. What's been spoken about quite a lot since is, I mean, England's best performance and result since 2019?
I think so. They've been flashes since then. I mean, they won a Six Nations title since then, but I mean, barely memorable. COVID, start of the COVID, the rugby was dreadful. Because of the quality of the opposition, the expectation and the way that they did it, particularly having had the better of the first half and then gone in down, at Murrayfield in that situation, they unravelled, and here they didn't. For all those reasons, it felt to me like the best, possibly most important win for a long time.
And can I ask you guys, as two people that are covering the team in such detail, have you been surprised at England's approach this Six Nations? Because both at Murrayfield and again in the Ireland game, I think there were many people that were maybe expecting England to revert back to what we saw in the semi-final, to go back to what they can do, make it an arm wrestle and try and hang in there to the end. Have you been surprised and, I suppose, impressed at the level of attacking intent and their all-round approach?
So I think there's maybe two strands to this. The first strand is that, yes, I was surprised that that was the game plan that beat Ireland and managed it, because I essentially, early in the week, said, well, let's look at the statistics of when Ireland lose. The last four times they've lost, so two against France, two against the All Blacks, what have been the sort of bellwether statistics that show a style to beat them? And all of it pointed to kick pressure, kick for 1,000 metres, play narrowly, don't play wide. And if you play too wide, they pick you off. And actually, interestingly, when Ireland lost, they played wide themselves and sort of overplayed, maybe. There are obvious things about make your tackles, have a very good set piece, don't concede loads of penalties, win some turnovers. But the way that England did it against Ireland was totally different to that. They cut in third their amount of kicking metres. They ran the ball back. That was the Furbank selection. Like, from the first time he got the ball deep in his own half, we did a piece on it on Monday, he ran it back, which is usually where they've been kicking it. But the seeds of that have grown through the Six Nations, and maybe if some of those passes had stuck at Murrayfield, we would have seen it a week earlier. But because they dropped the ball 25 times, they never got into that. But it feels like that's something they've been building on. And the second point of it is, I think there was an understanding. There's two points. So this second point, but the players spoke to Borthwick about wanting to play a more expansive style after the World Cup, didn't they? Jamie George, it's part of his Make Twickenham Great Again plan. Re-engage with the public. They understand that they have the talent to do it, so why not try and expand? And I think some of it maybe is Borthwick also trying to prove that he's not a one-trick pony and he can coach an attacking side, because there's this perception that he's just this ultra analyst. So all of that melded into one, I think, has produced what we saw.
And this was something that a colleague of ours said to me in the press room afterwards, we were waiting for the press conferences, but it was a game that England had to go and win multiple times, and that sort of character and also execution and execution under pressure is something that I feel like we haven't seen from an England team for a long, long time.
And this is where, and I don't know, without making it too much about us v them and all that sort of stuff, I think it has been entirely fair that we have been writing for a long time, where is it? Let's see it. And now we have seen it. It's entirely fair that we go, well done, you showed us it. I think a lot of the criticism we get from the team itself and people outside as the journalists who write about it is that it's sort of sing when you're winning and hammer them when they lose. And it's a bit like, well, it's much more nuanced than that. The media's a broad church. We're not all the same. We don't all think the same. But also, there was so little evidence of what they produced on Saturday for the last 4 years that there was a phrase we've used a lot is blind faith. There was a lot of blind faith that it would come off. And now that it has, and now that they have shown it, I think it's okay to just go, well done, England. They did a fantastic job. And that's not asking for it and demanding it and everything else. But I think it's okay to be constructively critical when they're not playing very well. They'll be more critical themselves than we are of them. And then say congratulations when they win, because they deserved it.
And significantly, three wins could end up being four, but it changes the whole complexion of this championship.
It is amazing, isn't it? One week to another.
The other thing that I really liked about this performance, and they should have delivered the same thing at Murrayfield, and the reason that they were criticised for Murrayfield was they made too many basic errors and then lost their direction.
And it adds to the tapestry of what we've been seeing for a long time, isn't it? It's not a one-off.
But it was clear, and I think has been reflected, that you could see what they were trying to do when it was going well. But what was so impressive for me was how they imposed themselves on Ireland, arguably the best team in the world. They're the best team in the world who are playing at the moment. I mean, they're not the world champions, different conversation, but they are playing, they're a complete team. And the way that England imposed themselves on Ireland through this blitz defence, which disrupted them, they disrupted their fluidity in attack, they slowed down their breakdown. I mean, Ireland traditionally have a really quick sort of 3 second breakdown. They added a whole second onto, England forced them to add a whole second onto that. So it slows down what they're doing. The blitz was up in their face, disrupting the passing avenues, and they put pressure on kicks, from which England profited. That is a team not just trying to react to what the opposition do. It's a team imposing themselves. And that was impressive for me. And there were a couple of... The blitz is I think it's a fascinating conversation, because this time last year, Steve Borthwick was saying, this England team are not fit enough. Not fit enough for Test rugby. Not fit enough for the Test rugby I want us to play. A year on, they've adopted a defensive strategy which is incredibly physically demanding, because you're running shuttles every phase. You're flying up, flying back, flying up, kind of rugby league style. Incredibly physically demanding, and yet achieving it, they're delivering it. And then the other area is that it's high risk, as we know, and there are times when you don't even have to get it wrong to be exposed. But they only broke the line twice. Their average line breaks in the last 2 years, when they've hit number one in the world and won a Grand Slam, is seven. And England prevented them from hitting anywhere close to their average in attack. And
I think they did score two tries in those line breaks as well, didn't they? Which is even more impressive that they didn't allow them any others.
Yeah, they did score two tries. And But as you were saying in your piece last week, Will, when England, when Ireland win, they score five tries a game and they have and make seven line breaks. And England restricted them to 2-2, which is a win. I mean, it wouldn't have felt it for those moments when Slade is sort of marooned and they're passing behind his back. But the system as it, you know, I thought Feo Oboso was a huge asset to that system, flying infield from out wide to make cover tackles. It worked, you know, and it's in its infancy, but you could see it working. And I liked England imposing themselves on Ireland and going chest out, and that's why the place was, I mean, literally shaking at the end.
It was unreal. Have you experienced Twickenham like that?
A couple of times.
When are the others?
Well, that last 10 minutes against New Zealand,
yeah,
when they came from nowhere to draw. I mean, it was a freak result. When Chris Ashton was running the length
against Australia
2010.
Yeah.
And I think when in that crazy basketball game in 2015 where England had to win by
55-35.
Yeah, yeah. And they were chasing a points difference win against France in the sunshine. It just had a kind of a festival feel about it. Everyone was really engaged in that one too, but not very often.
And it was unbelievable. And we say the significance of this result and this performance for this England team, I think also hugely significant in terms of this England team's relationship with the fan base, which we've spoken about loads before. We probably don't need to go into it again.
No, but there are characters in that team who are great individuals and great players. The way they play, never mind who they are as people, that you can really buy into. And I think Manny Feo-Oboso is one of them, because if you watch your England team and you see a guy who is just so powerful when he carries, electric down the wing, smashing people defensively, giving everything, they're the type of players that non-rugby people can see play and go, wow, like, what an athlete, what a guy, never mind what he's like as a bloke. You know, he's a cracking guy as well.
It's one of the best examples, I think, the England wingers, of how they have developed their game. Like, it wasn't that long ago at the World Cup we were talking about Henry Arundel getting the ball past him or whatever it is. Whereas
that was
now
the piece he wrote beforehand. It's, yeah, like, we've seen this tape before, a young winger getting picked in an Ireland game and never getting the ball. But thank God,
they're using them differently.
Feo-Oboso was used.
Though, aren't they?
Yeah.
Like Freeman
and he
looked
for the ball as well. It's on the player too, isn't it? Not just
it's definitely
the
on the player. And, you know, Arundel's got some freakish gifts. At the World Cup, England were picking their wings to chase kicks. I mean, make no bones about it. That's why they were there, to get up at that sort of one-handed tip-off back, which gives you an advantage over the catcher because you can just stick one hand up. That's really what they were there for. Borthwick talked about Arundel coming off his wing and looking for those passes off 9, off 10. He did it in the Chile game.
Following Marcus Smith
around.
Floated around, yeah,
following Marcus Smith on his shoulder, but that's the Chile game. We hadn't seen the best of him offensively because he was a wing, I think, still so raw, and he would just stay out wide. And I think the top 14 would be a great education for him, but, you know, defensively he's not the same as Manny. What was great from, as you say, Alfie Manny and Tommy Freeman, they're coming off the wing, they're looking for work, they're getting involved. It's a different style of attack, using players for the best of their, bringing the best of out of these players, using their skill sets, which Borthwick has always said he wanted, but we didn't see it last year because it wasn't actually the plan. But it is the plan now, and he's finding players that fit the system. Mm. That's the other thing, like,
which is what Ireland have done really well,
yeah,
under Andy Farrell,
yeah,
as well.
Can I just say we had a lovely, we're going to write about it on Monday afternoon, but we had a lovely chat with Manny Feo-Oboso afterwards, and last April he was playing for Taunton Titans in a relegation game against Leeds Tykes, and he is like gloriously naive about what he's doing at the moment in a really positive, fun way. Like, he was just standing there going, because someone asked him a question we ask a lot of people who've played their first couple of games, going like, oh, is there anything about this that you didn't expect?
I heard this, yeah.
And he was going, we've just got such nice hotels. Like, the hotel we stay in is brilliant. And then we go to other hotels and they're brilliant too. And we're on chartered flights. Ah, oh, it's just so crazy. It's all brilliant. And you're just like, wow, what a guy. Like, he's just loving life. And I think he was on the telly going, oh, Ellis Genge gave me a hug and I just melted and started crying and stuff like that. Yeah. That's the sort of stuff that's yeah, nice. Like, that you see these guys growing in the shirt and stuff like that, which Borthwick's talked about and said that people have shrunk before. Like Cunningham South's another one, I think, that, yeah, people could get behind. Like, the way he basically injured himself in a massive carry is heartbreaking for him because he's done his calf and is out of the squad. But that showed that kind of, I'm going to get the ball, I'm going to go and make a difference here.
Yeah.
And it's something that fans will just go,
I
come on,
I think there's a generation
brilliant
of them coming through. I mean, Ben Earl now established in the last 10, 12 months, establishing himself as a test match winning player. I mean, the number of man of the match awards he's got would be
and in big games as well, like quarter final, big game against Ireland
would be testament to that. You've got George Martin, like an absolute monster of a man, and what you know, he's his last two starts for England, he's been like phenomenal against Ireland and South Africa, the two probably best teams in the world, dominating, you know, hugely physical opposition, cunning himself, as you say. And then, you know, we're maybe a year away, but there's a whole generation of front row players ready to come through who've been dominating the under 26 nations. If you get to watch any England under 20s games,
they've got a massive front five.
Their front five is enormous, and yeah, it's age grade rugby. They're not up against men, but they are destroying opposition scrums.
They're like 20 stone, some of those guys.
Yeah,
and that is an area that you look at this England team and you do think, props in particular, it won't be too long that England needs some new players coming through.
You know, and I imagine Asha Opoku-Fordjour perhaps might go on the summer tour, maybe play against Japan, or at least just be around, spend a month training with Dan Cole, Joe Marler. I mean, England can't afford to move on from those two yet, but you know, I can imagine a Twickenham crowd seeing Asher come on, hitting his first
scrum. Getting well excited, yeah.
And everyone's buzzing. And if you get people buzzing about props, then we're all winning.
So I want to move on to the other games in just a second, speak about Ireland a little bit. And we've got Will's chat with Seb Negri coming up. Just finally, though, on England, I have seen it said. In fact, Owen Slott got in touch with us, Will,
as a reader. Not via our email,
which you can use if you want to get in touch with us, theruck@thetimes.co.uk. But he had a reader get in touch with him questioning whether England at the end should have gone, actually, rather than knocking over a drop goal with a penalty or very kickable penalty, should have tried to get themselves a bonus point try.
Yeah, reader Tim saying, yeah, should they? He already had a sitter of a penalty. Clear thinking England should have gone for the bonus point try. Personally, I think no one in the stadium was thinking, but the bonus point.
Yeah.
It's just like, just win the game.
There was one person thinking try, though. Joe Marler.
Right.
Joe Marler was running a line where if he'd had the pass, he would have scored. And on his Instagram, he's made it very clear that if he'd had the pass, he'd have scored his first ever try for England.
Has he never scored?
So yeah, he was thinking try. Joe Marler was thinking try.
Yeah, but I don't
one think, out of 81,000,
I was going to say 81,000 people were not thinking about that.
But maybe there is a wider point there. So actually, years ago when they didn't have bonus points, I remember being like, bonus points are a great thing because they keep the game ticking when you've already lost. But then you start seeing teams winning titles on bonus points like England did in 2020, and you go, oh, that's not really the Six Nations, is it? And like this weekend, there is a scenario where England win the title on bonus points and stuff like that.
Or there's a worse scenario. I was going to ask you about this later, but seeing as we've come onto it, where Ireland could lose but get a bonus point, and if England could win.
Yeah.
So England could have won more games than Ireland in this Six Nations.
And beaten Ireland.
And beaten them, but not win the title because Ireland have picked up more bonus points. That's where you feel, in a competition that is as short and sharp as the Six Nations,
and it's all
where
about
everyone plays everyone.
Beat the rival, beat your big brother, your little brother next to you kind of thing, isn't it? It's not about, but so less than seven.
That is a scenario that they had not planned for. They planned for the scenario that you could win the... You could do the Grand Slam and not finish first.
Yeah, because they've got that Grand Slam bonus, don't they?
You get a Grand Slam bonus to make sure that...
You definitely win the title, yeah.
They had not planned for the scenario where the title winners only win three games.
And someone's won four and finishes
second.
Someone
else has won four. I mean, England would be spewing if that happens. It would be...
They would genuinely... I reckon they'd actually change the rules if that happened.
No, they'd have to, yeah.
But not for this season, in future, yeah. It's always one of those things with rugby, isn't it, where... Not maybe just things like this, but in the law book, because you can't write everything down that happens.
Yeah.
Things happen and you go, right, that's never happened before. We should probably change the rules on that.
Let's move on to Ireland. I'm conscious we've spoken a lot about England, understandably, after such a great victory. A couple on Ireland, though. It was really interesting being in the press conference, and I know a massive part of this Ireland team and Andy Farrer's there, so level-headed. It's one game at a time. They don't get too high when they win, they don't get too low when they lose, and they kind of batted away the whole back-to-back Grand Slams is now out the window. I just wondered how big a disappointment when they reflect on it that is going to be, because that would have been historic, as we've spoken about, never done before in the Six Nations, and you feel it was really on for them this time round.
Andy Farrell was incredibly level, as you say,
as he always is,
and
he wasn't at half time.
No, well, no, when he had a little argument, with Borthwick.
Wigglesworth chipping away and Borthwick's there.
But he was very respectful of England, said they fully deserved to win. It would have been a travesty if we'd won that game type stuff.
But do you know what I mean?
But
though?
Yeah. But
whether privately, away from microphones and cameras, they're just there like, oh, man.
We may see it on next year's Netflix series, who knows? But because, look, you can read this two ways. And as you said earlier, It's incredible how much the conversation changes after 1 week. But you now could look at it and go, Ireland have bottled twice in the last 6 months. They've lost the World Cup quarterfinal they should have won, and they've not completed a back-to-back Grand Slams, which they were by miles going to do. And they were so much better than everyone else, as Warburton said. They should have beaten everyone by two scores. It was on for the most dominant slam ever, and they didn't do it. And England were really good. But so there is an... I'm not saying I believe that. I'm just saying you could argue that. Before this, it was they'd only lost two of their last 21, so that's now three out of 22. That's not bad, is it? Like, they're still an incredibly good team. I don't think we're all suddenly going, oh, Ireland are done, let's retire everyone, Omani's gone, all that. Like, that's really reactive. What will be interesting is how they come back, how they respond, because their series in the summer is massive against the Springboks. The
who
Box,
are smarting after the,
Box the
whole...
The Box hate the fact that anyone is going, Ireland are the best team in the world. Like, you see all of the people that are their sycophantic supporters on social media and stuff like that, they are despising that as a narrative. And so
I can
that's going to be awesome.
To a degree.
Yeah, you can. But it's just really funny because even any mention of it, like, properly gets their gills up. So it's slightly annoying that, like, we'd like it for player welfare reasons, but it's a two-match series, that, because a ding-dong, because it's going to end 1-1 and everyone's going to go, but is there more credit for Ireland winning away in altitude, whatever? But that's going to be in Ireland's next interesting challenge, isn't it? How do they respond and go and beat the Box away? Because then, if they've done that, if they've beaten the Box away and beaten New Zealand away in this Andy Farrell era, they're still a seriously incredible side. Like, no one does that, do they? Especially a European team.
They will regret it. When I spoke to Danny Kerr for his 100th cap, we talked about the 16 slam, and their unbeaten year turned into 18 games unbeaten, and they were a slightly different situation. They'd won the title four games into the 2017 Six Nations, went to Dublin.
By hammering Scotland by 60.
Went to Dublin and lost. And he still, we should have won that slam. We should have won that slam. And that would have been the first Six Nations back-to-back. This would have been the first Six Nations back-to-back. It's, you know, there's a reason it hasn't happened.
I like that. I was saying to people after the game on Saturday, I sort of enjoy those things that never get done, like those impossible tasks, that one day someone will do it. But it was a bit like, for years, no one ever won two Champions Leagues back-to-back. Obviously, the old European Cup they did, because Madrid won the first five, didn't they? But then Madrid won three in a row with Gareth Bale in the team and Ronaldo and all that. And you thought, okay, well, they're an unbelievable team. Like, the fact that the double slam is really difficult is a good thing, isn't it?
Calendar Grand Slam in tennis. I'm trying to think of other ones in other sports.
The Tiger
now.
Slam, wasn't there in golf when Tiger Woods would win?
He held all of them.
In the wrong order, but
exactly. On Ireland then, I mean, Alex, you kind of in agreement with Will here in that this is still a very, very good Irish team. There's no need to... I think it's unfair to kind of micro-analyse that Conor Murray's, I think, copying a lot of flack for that final Box kick and things like that. It's just one of those things that this team will come again. It was a day where England played really well and Ireland were maybe slightly off.
I looked, that was what do you do in that situation? A minute and a half to go. Is it more risky to try and hold on to the ball for a minute and a half deep in your own territory? Now, Ireland are actually quite, you know, they're a good team at going through the phases, but it is risky because England have got nothing to lose. They will pile in every breakdown. So then you have a major risk of sealing off, concede a penalty.
England couldn't kick any goals though, so they might have been.
just keep playing in the 5 metre channel and keep it wide. No, but or you kick and force England to score from deep, which they did, and England did one from there. You know, that's just a tactical decision that happens at the time, and if it backfires, it backfires. So I don't think this isn't the end. This isn't this doesn't feel to me like England 2017, where they didn't do the back-to-back slam, and the next year they came fifth. Like, and then they had to build themselves back up again. You know, I still think there's a lot of legs in this team.
And they still win the title this weekend, almost certainly. Yeah. You would have thought, wouldn't you?
Yeah, you would have thought. I mean, no one predicted
what would happen. Exactly,
weekend,
yeah, we have to be careful
great,
now.
Which is great, because the conversation on the radio last week was, has this been a fairly standard, mundane championship? Because Ireland were streets ahead of everyone else, and Scotland had the France situation, so they weren't 3 from 3 like they could have been. England hadn't found themselves. And now, thankfully, we've had a weekend that has ignited the whole thing. And you're looking at Italy and how far up the table can they finish. Yeah, you would still expect Ireland to go and win it. But France looked, admittedly, against a very green Wales team, but France looked better. Mm. So going to Lyon for England is going to be a mega challenge, because they're huge, and Lyon will be jumping as a place because they don't get Test rugby. So no, it's good. I'm excited for Super Saturday.
I like a stats quiz. So here's your weekly quiz.
Go on.
Oh, there's two answers to this. The last time Ireland lost to Scotland at home, and the last time Scotland won at either Lansdowne Road or the Aviva. I want 2 years, please.
So the last time Scotland won
in Ireland
at all, 2012.
Ooh, close. There's a reason why the answer is, there's two answers, essentially.
And what was the second question?
So when was the last time they won in Ireland, and when was the last time they won at the current stadium / the old stadium? Essentially, the last time they won in Ireland was at Croke Park, 2010.
Oh, right.
And the last time they've won at either the Aviva or Lansdowne Road before that was 1998.
Mm.
So history is there to be broken, but there's a lot of history that says Ireland are going to win weekend. Like, just looking at the last few results, so these are including the World Cup game, 36-14, 22-7, 26-5, 24-27, 31-16, 19-12, 27-3, like, underwinning these games very comfortably
But also on that, and this brings us quite nicely onto the Scotland-Italy game, but it would be so typical of this Scotland team as well, wouldn't it, in a way, to be able to go there and all of a sudden produce something, but they've already messed it up.
We don't have Mark on this week because he's staring at a wall, but yeah.
Mind you, he's a real Italiaphile. I mean, what's the phrase? He loves Italy.
Yeah.
He loves Italy.
And he writes really well about them, and has covered them more than anyone else, really, isn't he?
I'm fascinated by the Scottish mentality this week.
Mm.
Because I think Gregor Townsend's big challenge is to keep some of the more experienced, influential players on board. I don't mean there's going to be a revolt. I mean, does Finn Russell sit there and go, for goodness sake, this almost like a reality, dose of reality, that he's just going, we're just not good enough, we can't do this. Mm. We can't, you know, they get so far, they should have been 3 from 3, then they lose in Rome. This is a Scotland team that has been promising for 5 years. Like, we keep going, could this be the year?
I reckon longer than that, like back to sort of 16-17 with Cotter, they were is a really good Scotland
team.
They can't
take that next step. Get and I just again. Wonder whether someone like Finn, they need him on board this week if they're going to do anything. But I can imagine him just going, like, what the hell? We're never going to do it. And just being frustrated and do you know what I mean? And down on Scotland's chances when actually they need them all to be up to have a shot at Ireland.
Well, I tell you what, let's park it there. We'll get the Italian perspective first, because it started, as we've said already, that brilliant Saturday. First Six Nations home win in 11 years, and Will has been catching up with the Italian back rower Seb Negri.
Okay, so next on the pod, we're joined by a victorious Italian rugby player, and what a great phrase that is to say. Seb Negri, how are you feeling on Monday morning after that amazing win?
Can't really put it into words, to be honest. Yeah, a special and emotional day for myself, for the team, I think for the whole of Italy. Yeah, everyone's buzzing, but at the same time, you know, we fully focus now on the next challenge, which is Wales.
Yeah, and that's a very sportsman's thing to say, but you're going to have to reflect on Saturday first, if that's all right.
Yeah, well, to be fair, as soon as I came off, I think I came off around 60 minutes, and I had 20 minutes watching it from the side, and that was probably worse than being on the field, just because, I mean, I would have preferred just to have gone inside and and not watched. It was it was nerve-wracking, to say the least. And then for us to get over the line was emotional. Really, really emotional. It's been a long time. I've had a lot of ups and downs. We as a team have had a lot of ups and downs, been scrutinized a lot. So it was just everything just came over me. And yeah, there was a lot of emotion because, you know, that was my 54th test. And, you know, to get a win, my first win at the Stadio Olimpico in a Six Nations game was something that I'll never, ever forget.
Yeah, absolutely. So take us into the scenes then. When that final whistle goes, like, you've probably seen some of the videos doing the rounds of Ness and Dormer being put over it and things like that.
Yeah, well, I just, like, as soon as I saw that it went forward and we got the knock on, I think it was Liner next to me, Luigi, and I just jumped on him. And
is that what you're calling him, Luigi Liner?
Yeah, exactly. Nice. There's a good Italian twist on it. And it was just raw emotion. And like I said, it's been a long time and a lot of sacrifice behind that, a lot of hard work, a lot of disappointments. And, you know, when you finally get over the line, it's pretty special and something that I'll cherish forever. That's 100% for sure.
And if we spool on the evening a bit, I know you're in the middle of a tournament and you've got a game on coming up on Saturday in Cardiff, but you've got to allow yourself a few Peronis after that, right?
100%. No, you got to enjoy these wins and celebrate and take it all in, and that's exactly what we all did as a group. But I definitely would say that, you know, we had a team meeting this morning and even a really good recovery day yesterday. Yeah, I guess a few heads would have been a bit sore, but you know, our full focus now is on Cardiff, because now we've got a real opportunity to create more history, and you know, we can't take anything for granted. We've put ourselves in a really good position, and now it's about, you know, finishing the Six Nations as strong as we can.
Just how pleased are you? Like you said there, you've won 50-odd caps and you've had probably a handful of wins in that time, especially in the Six Nations. Just how pleased are you that you've got that validation? And it seems that lots of different things are coming now with Italian rugby, like the ground selling out. Had 65,000 odd people there, didn't you? The under-20s are pulling out some performances. The national team's now pulling out performances. Like, it feels like it's growing. Benetton are winning regularly in the URC. It's all coming together.
Yeah, 100%. I think, you know, it's all the sacrifices, all the disappointments, you know, that one game, you know, is made up for all of that. But I think now the next job for us is, yes, we got to enjoy those wins and, you know, we're making huge stride forward, but the next job for us is consistency. You know, we can't have two or three good results and then, you know, get hammered or lose or, you know, go on another losing streak or whatever. So now for us is to be consistent and pretty much be what Scotland have been, I think, over the last couple of years. You know, when they probably weren't as consistent a couple of years ago, they're one of the best teams in the world, and we got to strive towards that. And I know that's what's on everyone's mind at the moment. And we got a really, really good group of players now and players that are coming into sort of, you know, their prime, and we're getting a lot more experience within the group, and I think that helps. So yeah, we're in a really good cycle, but now it's up to us, and we got to take responsibility to, you know, to strive for that consistency, I guess. So, you know, remain ambitious and keep fighting for results, keep fighting for respect, but consistency's got to be, you know, the goal for us, and also keeping our feet on the ground. You know, it's very easy to get carried away after, you know, one or two wins, but you know, feet firmly on the ground, and we've got a big job to do to make sure we finish the Six Nations on a high.
Let's talk a little bit about Luigi then, shall we? Your new cap. Yeah. He must think that this stuff's easy, right? Just comes in one game, scores a try, win.
Well, I saw his interview after the game, and he said he could have retired because it's one cap, one try, one win. He's a very young, talented player, and you know, I'm sure this is just the start for him. He's brought in a real, what can I say, a lot of energy about him. He's brought that into the group. You know, I see his quality in training. He's a big physical specimen, and yeah, I'm sure this is just the beginning for him. And you know, what a way to start your international career. And yeah, extremely delighted for him. Also, just because he's a really good kid.
We've talked about this a little bit with maybe some of the young guys coming into the England team, but is there something in those guys who don't have fear, maybe, and they haven't had the baggage of the years gone by, that they bring that exuberance, and I don't know, that they're not thinking, they're not seeing the demons maybe where other players might have been?
Yeah, like me.
No, I didn't mean it like that, but you know what I mean. That kind of why not atmosphere kind of thing.
Yeah, 100%. I think he has brought brought that in, and the young players do bring that in. And then I think you just got to, you know, make sure there's a balance between youth and experience. And at the moment, I think we have that. And, you know, like I said, I think we, you know, we're really coming into our own as a team. I think a lot of the boys are becoming a lot more experienced. And you know, these wins and this taste of success is only going to help this group go forward. And like I said, we've got to keep our feet on the ground. You know, it's one win, but, you know, there's a lot of ambition in the group, and we're on to the next challenge.
Just on him too, obviously he's coming to Benetton next season after leaving Harlequins, isn't he, Lewis Liner? Not Luigi, yep. As we call him Lewis over here. it's just another savvy recruitment, I guess, from the Italian rugby sort of system, isn't it? To pick up a player who's got an Italian mum and has got a good chance of playing a lot of international rugby.
Yeah, for sure. And I think he's very young, but he's had a really good career so far at Harlequins, and he'll bring that sort of experience, I guess, from the UK to Benetton. And, you know, he's going to add a lot of quality to the group, I'm sure, and, you know, at Benetton, but also in the international group. And I'm just excited to see how he gets on. Like I said, I think he's a really talented player, but, you know, more importantly, he's a good kid. And, you know, it's the same for people like Ross Vincent. I think he's been really awesome too. So
still at university, I think, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. So, you know, for those two guys to come in and to perform and hit the ground running, to get that win, I think, you know, is extremely special for them. And like I said, it's, you know, it's great that they're top young players, but they're good people and they work hard, and you know, that's a really good thing for us.
Well, one more young guy I'd love to ask you about too, because he seems to have been a bit of a star of the last few months, is Tommaso Melanchello, playing in the centre, playing on the wing, only 21. There's people who think he could be up there as one of the best in the world at the moment in the centres. How good is he from your perspective?
Well, like I said, he's another one, you know, that's young, ambitious. He's a massive, massive athlete, really big, strong, robust, powerful centre. That can also play on the wing, but, you know, extremely physical, and he's got all the ingredients to be world class. I think he's showing glimpses of it now, but I've seen it over the last few years. You know, at the club and now with the international stuff, you know, he's up there with the best, and I'm sure, you know, this is only the beginning for him. He's had a lot of disappointment, you know, with injuries, and he's bounced back from that, and I think this is just the beginning. So I think watch the space for Tommy. Like I said, he's got all the ingredients to be the best in the world.
So looking at next steps, Seb, Cardiff, look, they haven't won a game yet. That's been a position you've been in for a while, but you've got a real chance now of doing something the Italian rugby hasn't done for a long time, and that's finishing fourth or above. It could be even further, couldn't it? I mean, just looking at this, the last time Italy finished fourth in the Six Nations, 2013, and before that, 2007, and never higher. So it's historic stuff you're looking at in Cardiff. Is that a driving force going over there?
Yeah, 100%. I think, like I said, you know, we got to enjoy the celebrations against Scotland, but the message was loud and clear from Gonzalo and the coaching staff, and also from the boys, is that let's enjoy the Scotland win, but we're on to the next one, because, you know, we've got a great opportunity to make history and to chase that consistency I was talking about. So, you know, we want to finish this tournament as, you know, as strong as possible, but we're under no illusions either. You know, we're going to face a hurting Wales side that's going to throw a lot of punches at us, and we got to prepare as best we can, because, you know, it's going to be a tough test match, as it always is. And, you know, it would be silly to think we're going over there and it's going to be, you know, sunshine and rainbows and we're going to get an easy win. So yeah, I think we're up for a big test match. We got to focus on what we can control, our preparation, and then, you know, give it everything and see where we end up.
And just on a personal note, the win 2 years ago that broke the duck, for which extended back so far, you weren't part of that, because, as people know who've watched the Netflix series, you obviously had your horrible knockout against England a few matches before. So you want to be part of an away win too, don't you?
Yeah, for sure. You know, I was so chuffed watching the boys get that win in Wales a couple of years ago, and I was sat on my sofa So, you know, now that I'm back in the mix and fighting with this group of boys, you know, I want to be on the right side of that result too. And that's definitely, you know, it added its incentive for this weekend. But, you know, we need to prepare well. We need to be fully focused because, like I said, it's going to be a tough, tough test. And, you know, we got to be at it. And, yeah, I'm really looking forward to the challenge.
Awesome, Seb. Well, pleasure to have you on the ruck. Glad that your hangover subsided. Well played on Saturday. And all the best for going over to Cardiff. It's great to see Italian rugby thriving again.
Thanks so much, mate. Thank you so much.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
So great to hear from Seb Negri there. Always nice to chat to him, Will. Get a little insight from the Italian camp.
Yeah, we interviewed him at the start of the tournament before the England game, and obviously as the star of a Netflix show, he had plenty to talk about. And yeah, engaging character. And it is mad, like we always thought about this, didn't we, with Sergio Parisa, where I think he's the only player to have ever lost 100 tests. Like, he played 140 or something. But it just must be the best feeling in the world when you've been coming to and from camps all the time, and maybe this time, maybe this time, maybe this time, maybe this time, not this time. 50-odd caps and a handful of wins, as we mentioned, and you get one and you just think, thank God for that. And deserving it and everything else. Brilliant.
And one of the things I feel with this Italian team, hopefully, fingers crossed, is there's maybe the sense that with what we're seeing in the under-20s with Italy, some of the performances we're seeing in terms of the URC, that maybe it's not just that one Six Nations win they get every 5 years or whatever. It's something they can build upon. On the flip side of that, quickly just to finish things off on Scotland, I know we briefly mentioned them before we heard Will's chat with Seb. There was a line in Mark Palmer's piece, which I thought was very revealing, perhaps, which was, for Gregor Townsend, Scotland, it was yet another iteration of the same old story, whereby this team's ability to implode against anyone, anywhere, at any time, constantly undermines their progress. And Alex, I do wonder, with this Scotland team, in the same way saying with Italy, you hope it's not just the one win and a nice moment, it's something they can build upon, is the fear with Scotland, this isn't just a disappointing defeat where they were off their game, but almost a sense of fatality, something you were kind of mentioning before, that this is a side that will never kick on to be genuine contenders.
Yeah, and that's clearly the feeling around the team from guys like Mark, who are out in Rome, and you can tell that because they asked Gregor Townsend a question about his future. You know, and I think that probably sums up the mood. It's not, they're not calling for his head, but it's more like, have you taken this team as far as they can go? Vern Cotter moved Scotland on. I think Gregor Townsend has moved them on again. What's fascinating now for me is I guess, as I alluded to before, perhaps beyond just their immediate bounce back this week, is what can, you know, can this setup evolve Scotland to take that next step?
Never had a shot at the title on the final day, as we've mentioned a few times in the Six Nations. They don't this time. They've never finished second in the Six Nations. Their peaks were last year third, 2013 third, 2006 third, 2001 third, otherwise fourth, fifth and sixth. Yeah, they could end seriously low in this tournament, depending on results, couldn't they? And we say this about a lot of sporting teams, but it's just maddening experience for being a Scotland fan, writing about them, because you just think, how could you do that after that? Or whether it's positive or negative, you just think, where's that come from on both sides? You just think...
It's the classic... Gosh. It's the hope that kills you. There was a long time totally. When Scotland were dreadful and they would give anything for a bit of hope. And now they've got some hope.
They're so much better than they were, yeah.
It's maddening for them.
Yeah. I tell you what, let's move on to Wales-France. Final game of the weekend on Sunday for the best part of 70 minutes. I was wondering if we were going to get that other upset of the weekend. France end up blowing them away and actually were pretty comfortable in the game. What was both of your reads on this match? It's an interesting one, right? So to peel the curtain back a little bit, I was reporting on it for TalkSport, but not from Cardiff, was doing it from the office, which is basically where you end up watching a game. And so you don't have any commentary. You're just watching it in a booth. It's kind of like, sounds really sad. A real quiet booth on your own set, which sometimes I think gives you a different perception on the game to a lot of other people. Because my view on it was, it's a continuation of what we've seen from Wales, a green team that aren't quite ready to be able to win, but you can understand why Warren Gatland, after matches, is saying, I think this team will be a good team in a few years' time. And for France, my thoughts on them was actually it was a game where I still don't really know where this French team are, because they coughed up some tries. Their defence at moments wasn't great, but we saw some of that flair, and they've put 45 points on Wales away from home, and I felt like maybe plenty of other people felt more positively about them. Where are you guys with
I was
Wales
watching it with a friend who's a Wales fan, and we were looking at it and going, it looks like both teams aren't very good, and also I was saying that it doesn't look like France have got sort of any plan in attack. They've gone sort of reverted to the sort of like, give it to Penno and just sort of, cool, oh good, he's done something, brilliant. It obviously is probably much more sophisticated than that, but just the look of it is much more broken and shambolic and sort of reliant on that very stereotypical French flair thing. It doesn't seem like that kind of really concerted, drilled team they were in 22 and up to the quarterfinal of 23. Well, the quarterfinal of 23, they were unbelievably good and just lost by a point, didn't they? But I suppose the other thing that stood out is just the absolute enormity of their bench. Like Elgin Elderman's done a sort of a follow-up piece from that match and noted that the French pack was approaching 1,000 kilograms. With like replacement for Antonio was Georges-Henri Colomb, and coming on for Meafu, who's also enormous, was Romain Thauvin Fifanua, and both of them are 22 stone. Like, England will think they've probably got a good chance, and they do, of beating France and Lyon, because France are clearly not the team they have been, but they're going to have George Martin and the lads are going to have a day where they stand up some pretty heavy artillery, aren't they, Alex?
Yeah. I think, just looking at the Wales perspective, I still don't understand why he didn't start Nick Tompkins and George North in midfield. It seemed a very odd game. Odd selection decision.
So, like, why this game? Yeah.
Yeah, I don't get it. They're so obviously the best centre pairing that Wales have.
The best possible explanation for that I've seen, which maybe doesn't explain why this game in particular, but was, you know how we've spoken so much about Warren Gatland inherited a team that had either absolutely bags of experience or none whatsoever. There was no middle ground.
Yeah.
And whether at some point you have to give guys experience.
I mean, definitely, because and it leads into, he's in a situation, we talked about where Ireland are trying to evolve from a place of success, and where England are trying to build something under pressure to win. Gatland's doesn't have the pressure to win. You know, he's building a new team, and I think there's an acceptance that they're going to be giving everything, and they're going to be keen, and they're going to be flying around as much as they can. You know, I think their replacement Hooker's never started a professional rugby
crazy.
Game. Like, Cameron
Lloyd.
Burnett's had a really good Six Nations, but he's raw, you know. So Gatland's got greater freedom. I still don't know why you wouldn't start with your best team and bring some of these guys on, maybe, especially at home.
And switching both centres as
well. Yeah, against a France team who are vulnerable, enormous, but vulnerable because of the frailties they've shown and the injuries they've got. I thought it was an odd selection, even within the context of what Wales, where they are and what they're trying to achieve. I think Gatland will forge something out of this team. He'll be afforded the time to do it, which Steve Borthwick wouldn't be. You know, that's just the reality of where England are and where Wales are and the systems and the setups and the expectations. I think he'll forge something pretty good out of this team, and he'll get some injured players back. but they're a long way off.
I can see Italy beating them. Wales are, I think, the most boom or bust team in the Six Nations. I don't know what it is, whether it's once they get on that momentum roll, they just can't be stopped because of everything that comes with Wales doing well in the Six Nations. And when they start losing, all that unravels so quickly. I mean, just looking at their last few finishes. So this is from 2019 onwards. First Grand Slam, next year, fifth.
Yeah.
2021, first, nearly got the Grand Slam, next year, fifth. 2023, fifth, and this year they could get sixth. So like, they just go, you wrote about the Manhattan graph and England's more looking like a Croydon. Theirs is crazy. It's just way up or way down.
Yeah.
And actually now they would be consistently fifth and then sixth, and they haven't clutched the Welsh love spoon, the wooden spoon, since 2003. Before that, they've only had sort of a clean set of defeats in 95, 1990, and then not before that until the 50s. So, like, they don't get spooned very often, but they're staring at it at the moment, aren't
they? It's the amazing thing about the Six Nations, though, as we keep saying, isn't it? In that you look back at their opening game against Scotland, weren't far away from an unbelievable comeback.
Yeah.
You look back at the game against England at Twickenham, could easily have ended up winning that game as well. It's such fine margins sometimes. What is, I think, interesting for Wales, and not to get too far ahead of ourselves, is their tour to Australia is going to be really interesting, isn't
it? You just want to go back to Aussie, don't you?
I do, yeah. Well, I've got to book the next flights. That's the end of the year.
Yeah, it will be. And they're making it into a proper tour, which actually you think might help them grow some of that cohesion and sort of bring through these young guys who've hardly played any rugby. Like, they're going to play the Queensland Reds. They've got South Africa at Twickenham because I think the Foo Fighters or someone are playing at, or is it Taylor Swift is playing at the Principality Stadium. So they did that in 2016 as well with Warren Gatland, where they played the All Blacks but also got thrashed by the Chiefs. And that grew
England
them into a decent team.
England at Twickenham.
So it's that similar theme of trying to get a group together on a proper sort of almost like Lions-y type
tour.
Which just Gatland will galvanise them there, you think?
Get this young group together for as long as he can, play as many games as they can. I mean, that South Africa test, you know, the Bulls players might not be there because they might be in the URC final on the same day. There won't be any Welsh teams in the URC final. So he just wants as much time with them as possible. And, you know, he's got a track record with Wales, which I guess helps. You know, he's got this gravitas of having defied lowly regional performances and created Grand Slam winning Wales teams, and he's got to do it again. And the fact he's done it before probably allows him some grace from the pressure. And, you know, I do think he'll, you know, I don't think they'll be finishing fifth and sixth all the way through to the next World Cup. And he won't go on the Lions tour, so he'll have another tour on that next summer as well with a lot of these players who also won't go on the Lions tour. So
they've got players to come back as well. There are some people that can't.
Jack Morgan,
Liam Williams, Thomas Francis. There's a few kind of more.
Anscombe might be coming back to the UK.
There's a few more experienced players that I think will come back into that team as well. We'll wait and see. Next up, we'll finish off this week's pod. We'll do our God or Goddess of the Week, and I'm going to get some predictions for this weekend from Will and Alex. So, Super Saturday, final weekend of the 2024 Six Nations.
We made it.
Well done to both of you. You've got through another Six Nations Championship. Looking ahead then, so we said earlier, Ireland, don't expect any major shocks there. They'll wrap up the title. How do you see England going away to France?
It's really hard to judge, actually, isn't it? I think they probably, well, in usual circumstances, you say they wouldn't win, but France haven't been very good and England have got that massive momentum spike, so you think now, having just seen what they did on Saturday, they probably should win, but it's probably going to be fairly tight, you think?
It's a really good challenge for England. They can't stick up headlines and clippings and audio clippings on the changing room wall anymore, because there's no one saying,
look at how nice they are being to you, go and prove them wrong on Saturday, boys.
No one ever said they were the worst team in the world, as Ben Earl has obviously been told that people were saying about them. They might have said that they haven't lost four Calcutta Cups in a row for 100 years or whatever it was. But
I doubt he's got an Irish Times or an Irish Independent subscription.
No one's been saying that about England, that they're that bad. So it's obviously a device they've been using. They won't have that to lean on now. But they've got belief. And I'm sure that technique, whatever you call it, strategy of creating the siege mentality around England, no one believes in us, they all hate us, we don't care type of stuff, which carried them through the World Cup and was clearly in use last week, is a substitute for belief. They had nothing through, you know, up until that semi-final game, really. Maybe the Argentina performance was probably the biggest statement they could have made last year to at least give themselves something to hold on to. Now,
but they didn't back it up against Japan, though, did they, in their next game? I mean, they won.
They won, but
they won, but it was unconvincing.
It was unconvincing, although they would say that they knew that they had outlasted Japan, so their numbers told them that stay in it for an hour and then we'll pull clear.
But actually,
which they did do.
They can run France around. Sam mentioned on the pod last week that if you watch the middle of the field when France are playing, look at how slow some of their big forwards are. We mentioned the 1,000-kilo pack. Like, if England play the way they played against Ireland, they could seriously trouble France.
That's exactly what I was going to say. So you've got, they don't need to, they've got, what this whole sort of siege mentality thing is a substitute for belief. They've got something tangible now. As Borthwick, I asked him after the game, and he's like, I can tell them as much as I want, as much as I can, that all the metrics are showing that the team are getting better. But until you deliver it, that's when the belief arrives, and they'll have a belief in a conviction in what they're doing, and the way they played aggressive, quick ball, high tempo rugby. I think they'll believe in that now because it's worked for 1 week, and it'll work against an enormous France team, or they'll believe it can work against an enormous France team. So, yeah, I think England have a good chance of going and winning a team, because France are. They're down, obviously they're down Dupont, they're down to the third choice 10, doesn't play 10 regularly. Like, it's an opportunity for England.
L'opportunité est énorme, as Renegar would say.
Exactly.
Without the F word in the middle.
all right, we're going to move on to God or Goddess. Just a reminder as well to listeners, do get in touch with us. We've got an email now, theruck@thetimes.co.uk, and someone has done just that this
week. We've got an email! Yes, thanks to Marcello, who's emailed us, who does his own Italian rugby podcast, Il Tricolore. And we mentioned actually one of his two questions to Seb Negri about Tommaso Menoncello, because he reckons he's one of the best centres in the world at the moment, only 21. It's bonkers how good he is, Marcello writes. But the second one's interesting. Is there a case for Italy, if they go on to beat Wales and potentially finish third in the table, being the most impressive side in this year's Six Nations? He says Ireland have been underwhelming, maybe just in one game. France very poor. England and Italy could lay claim to being the most impressive side. I think there is a case for Italy the more impressive side in the Six Nations.
In football, they'd call it XG, or like it's the expected
goals
thing. What's the mean? What's expected
finish would have been sixth. So if they come third, yeah, it's massively better.
They beat France. I mean, they should have beaten France. Then they've exceeded expectations
by miles.
And who else would have done? England. Probably par at the moment. They lost a game that they thought they should win, and maybe won a game that form would say they lost. But England having three wins at the moment is about par. Ireland are probably about par because you can't ever bank on a Grand Slam. So yeah, I think what Gonzalo Quesada's done in moving that Italian team forward is really impressive. And when we were up in Scotland a few weeks ago with Mark, we talked about the kind of. They've got that foundation. They're recruiting or selecting, finding players. I mean, Louis Lyon is not a recruit. He was born in Italy with an Italian mother, but he comes in and improves the team. So I think they're in a good place. So yeah, there's every reason why Quesada could be coach of the championship, and Italy could be the sort of the story of the competition.
No, thanks for getting in touch. Just a reminder of the email, theruck@thetimes.co.uk, and Will will be manning the inbox.
Can't move for them, Alfie.
He was very excited this morning.
I know.
He had 8 emails, but 7 of them were from IT.
I can tell you that there's been issue accessing Proofpoint Quarantine that is our inbox.
We need more than one listener email.
Yeah, and I think final weekend of the Six Nations, whichever you're country you're from, you will have thoughts on your team, on what you've seen, so do get in touch.
Or maybe, hey, look, back to the Premiership soon as well, so there'll be plenty of stuff to get into with that, won't there?
Premiership Cup final weekend.
Oh, yeah. Is that bigger than Cheltenham's Gold Cup, do you think, on the Friday?
Don't think we're doing a pull-out in the paper for it, unlike the Cheltenham Gold Cup.
I don't know.
Okay.
It could be up there.
Let's wrap it up then. God or Goddess of the Week. Will, what direction are you going in?
I'm going for the run-it-back talents of George Furbank. I think it was a sign of Borthwick's actually pretty good man management that we've seen in this tournament to give him another go. It would have been easy to go safe and say, look, come on, Freddie Stewart, you're the guy, we know what you're going to do. But the way Furbank ran the ball back, showed that bravery, that conviction and the execution to beat Ireland, he kept coming. He actually did make a couple of mistakes, but I think he kind of symbolised the way that England didn't go into their shell when they were 17 points to 8 down with half an hour left. And so fair play to him. Like, I'm pleased with him because he would admit himself he got his first cap probably a bit too early when he wasn't really ready and slightly thrown under the bus a bit.
The way that those guys got introduced to test rugby compared to Manny Fair were both so, like, what a contrast. You've got a guy there who's just had two really impressive cameos off the bench and then starts his first game and looks to the manner born. So he's going to get my vote. I was just so impressed with the way he went about this, the biggest rugby day of his career, and made a difference for England. You know, he wasn't there for the ride. He wasn't there to be given the ball on the wing. He went out and imposed himself on the game on both sides of the ball. Really exciting. The kind of guy that Twickenham are going to be hopefully excited to watch for a long time.
So it's going to be an England clean sweep, which I feel is understandable after the victory against Ireland. A little harsh on Italy, really, after the performance and result that they put in. It was good to chat to Seb Negri. Obviously, Italy, brilliant, and a lot of good performances in there. I just wanted to mention Danny Kerr. Didn't really mention him before, but 100th cap. Really nice moment when he came on. You always feel like there's, for obvious reasons, a big Quinn support at any England game. Basically got a standing ovation when he came on, and all the more impressive, I think, for his career and the way it's played out, in the fact that he was in the wilderness for years. One of those, was he the Japan game or no? He just he was one of the Japan game players under Eddie Jones that you thought you'd never see from again. Then got himself back into the team under Eddie Jones, but then hooked in the first half of that final test away to Australia on that summer tour, which was another moment where you thought his international career might be over, but he's come back in and to get to 100 caps, and by all accounts, a brilliant bloke as well.
Yeah, great bloke.
Yeah, so three nominations then for England, as I say, probably understandably. Good to be back with you. Enjoy the final weekend of the Six Nations. As we say, do get in touch with us for your views on your team following the final weekend, and we will be back with you next week, Will and Alex, with a dispatch, hopefully, from Lyon. They'll be spoilt for choice for some nice bistros and bars.
Culinary capital.
The belly of France, they call it, don't they?
Oh, that's a tough gig, isn't it? For
ours have grown significantly over the tournament, so that's probably a bad thing.
So, yeah, we'll have a look back on the tournament. We'll hear from a number of the other writers as well, covering the various different teams. Enjoy your week. Enjoy Lyon, boys.
Thank you, Alfie. Thank you. Good to have you back.
And we will speak to you, or you will hear from us, next week.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.